It's so disorienting because it's not about you anymore. Your knowledge and your degrees won't save you. And you have to step into this role as a parent and assume the vulnerability of taking care of somebody. It's not a dress rehearsal. Your actions impact the conditions in which children grow. And it's like, it gets real pretty quick when you step into that role as a parent. But what a wonderful thing and a life-changing, life-altering, transformational experience to go from adulthood into parenthood. You are never the same way again.
I believe that love is all around us. Love is everything and everywhere. I am love. You are love. We are all love. In our divinity, in our soul, in the truest and simplest form of our being, we are pure, unconditional love. Love is the answer to everything. Every week in this podcast, we're talking to incredible and beautiful people who will be sharing their insights and perspectives to help you find more peace, to help you come from a place of love more often, to help encourage you to be kinder to yourself and others, to help you create more happiness in your life, to help you feel more oneness with others, and to help you connect to your higher self. My name is Justin Court. Together, we will help shift the collective consciousness of the planet to be more loving, kind, peaceful, happy, empathetic, understanding, and accepting. This can only be achieved together. It starts with each and every one of us. We are one, and it's time we start acting that way. I am so, so grateful that you're here. I love you, I support you, and I'm here for you. Let's together create more love in this world. Let's do this. Today's guest helps grown-ups understand kids through relational and developmental science. Dr. Deborah McNamara is a developmental and clinical counselor. She's also a teacher, guide, and mother. As a trusted and experienced clinical counselor for over 25 years in mental health and educational settings, as well as private practice, Deborah serves as a leading international expert who provides counseling and educational services to support parents, professionals, and educators. Deborah specializes in the relational developmental approach based on the work of Dr. Gordon Neufeld, empowering parents to become the expert on their children with everyday questions and practical strategies. Four things that she said children need are attachment, to feel vulnerable feelings, to play, and emotional and psychological rest. She's also the author of her new book, Nourished: Connection, Food, and Caring for Our Kids and Everyone Else We Love. All right, everybody, welcome to this episode of the podcast. Please welcome Deborah McNamara. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Justin.
Yes, all the parents out there, or if you have friends who are parents, maybe this can help you understand them a little bit more. But anybody out there right now who is a parent like me, me and Deborah were just talking before I hopped on. We have almost a two-year-old and then a newborn. So I am excited to have this conversation and learn from you, pick up some tips and just like new perspectives and new ideas on how I can be, it's not even like how I can be the best parent, but how I can give the best life to my children, how I can raise them in a loving, I love this, a loving and a nourished environment, how I can just be there for them to create this sort of a space for them. So yeah. I really am just excited to learn some from you.
Thanks. It's a beautiful intention. It's exactly what they need.
You know, it's wild. Years ago, so I'm 37, and if I had a child 10 years ago, I would have never, that would even been a thought, I don't think really. I would have been like, okay, let me just try to get through this. Let me, you know, do the best that I can. But I think it would have been more like survival mode than actually a conscious parenting.
Yeah.
Do you ever see that in like different age groups with people, just like as you're younger to maybe as you're getting older, more mature, where it's just like a different sort of parenting?
Yeah, well, I certainly was an older mom myself in my 30s, right? So I oftentimes have that same thought, oh my goodness, what if I'd been younger? And I actually watched my sister who had her first kid at about 22. She's an incredible mother. And in fact, I think her intuition was a little bit more richer for not having gone to school, you know, being more educated, not, you know, talking you out of your intuition that way. So there was certainly some gifts in being a younger parent and certainly more energy. Oh my goodness. Was that ever the 20s? Oh, you have so much more energy at that point. What I will say, which I find incredibly beautiful, is that no matter the age that you become a parent or assume responsibility for a child, there's this innate set of instincts and emotions that come to the surface when you take responsibility for taking care of, when you have responsibility for taking care of a child. When someone else's life is in your hands, there's this beautiful, blossoming of these emotions that help you. So I think that happens at every age, which is good, but certainly different ages provide different challenges, energy, education, finances, whatever it might be. But we are able to take care of a child at any age.
Mm. You know, as we're talking about this, my father and mother-in-law, they had my wife and her sister when they were in like their early to mid 20s. And I asked her mom that recently. I was kind of like, how did you guys, I look at myself and that's all I can really compare to. And me at that age, the word disaster kind of comes to mind real quickly. I was living in New York City and I was just drinking a lot and partying a lot. And that was just my life at that time. And I just imagine me trying to raise a child just with where I was developmentally and my emotions, my mindset, my being. But when I was talking to her, she's like, honestly, she's like, we had so much energy, right? We were so young. We were able just to be in it. We did. We just had a lot of energy and we just kind of went with it. You know, we didn't like stop and overanalyze everything. They're really beautiful, good people. So they just follow their intuition and they just move forward in that way. And as she was talking to me, I was like, wow, that actually sounds nicer and even more simple than kind of how I'm approaching things right now.
Well, I mean, I think we're just all where we're at in our life experiences that we bring to it. You know, when I was a parent in the 30s, you know, when I was 36, when I first became a parent, I mean, I had lots of advantages that way, but there was lots of disadvantages too. I remember I had my PhD was done. I was running, million-dollar research projects. I was, had achieved all sorts of stuff in my career, but then I had a child and I'm like, I know nothing. I'm back at square one again. I'm learning all over again. Yes, I studied attachment theory. I know all this knowledge and wisdom, but I'm back at the beginning again, trying to figure out, well, how do you deal with a temper tantrum? How do you deal with resistance and opposition? What if they won't sleep through the night? What's the kindest, most caring way to do this? You know, should I, adopt this sleep method? And you're hit with all of this stuff. And, it's so disorienting because it's not about you anymore. Your knowledge and your degrees won't save you. And you have to step into this role as a parent and assume the vulnerability of taking care of somebody. It's not a dress rehearsal. Your actions impact the conditions in which children grow. And it's like, it gets real pretty quick when you step into that role as a parent. But what a wonderful thing and a life-changing, life-altering, transformational experience to go from adulthood into parenthood. You are never the same way again. But nobody can tell you this. Getting a dog is not even close to raising a child. I don't care what anybody says.
Honestly, the things that you were just saying, I need to hear that as a new parent. It is like starting from square one. I didn't think that was going to be the case. You know, I thought I've worked so hard on myself over these last 6 or 7 years to step forward in love every single day, to get myself into a perspective where, yeah, craziness can happen, but finding a place of peace and alignment and stillness in these moments. And now having children, I'm like hanging on by like a thread to those
things. wonderful research project. There's a book actually called All Joy and No Fun. And they tracked parents of young children and their emotions during a day. And then they tracked people who didn't have children and their emotions during a day. And the people who didn't have children, they were pretty baseline still, you know, just a little bit of variability. People who had young children, it was like a roller coaster, because one of the things that we have to do, or we are responsible for as a parent, is to help make room for the emotions that our children have in us and try to figure out how to walk through that. And so, of course, what you're doing is you're not only having your emotions, but you're tracking and attending to someone else's emotions. And preschoolers live in the moment. So they go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. So this is part of the emotional work of parenting, is young preschoolers, you know, young children under the age of six, they're just in the moment with their emotion. And so too their parents go.
You know, I feel like you just kind of mentioned, like the wavelengths, I feel like mine were just really very even, like a little bit down, a little bit up, a little bit, but like not very much over the past 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And it's just, it is, you know, having the second child now, it's like, it's throwing me for a big loop where I'm up, up, up. And then it's a roller coaster, biggest drop down ever.
Yep.
And I honestly, in hearing it from you too, and your experiences and just, and who you are, your PhD and your knowledge in this just makes me, it helps me to like take a breath, because
good.
There's a lot of judgment, and that's something too. I worked a lot on like not judging myself in life, and I, through this experience, I'm judging myself. It's like, I think I should be better than I am in moments. And mm-hmm. I'm not giving myself, I think, the allowance to be like, hey dude, this is brand new. Like, I know you think you had a good lock on things before, but this is totally different. And I like I just keep going back to that, the starting from square one, because that's what it feels like. And I never clicked to that yet. I always thought, no, I have this experience. I've worked on myself. I'm like, you know, five legs ahead, and I'm realizing, yes, that's helping me. I think, not even, I think I know being a better parent, but mm-hmm. all these challenges are, they're still there. It doesn't just diminish and wash away all the hardship and the challenges.
No, I mean, emotions are powerful. Yeah. Emotions are, I mean, not only are we growing a child, but they're growing us up too as adults. And it's like, you thought you know, you've had all your growth experiences, and then you realize you get a child, and wow, you know, they find their emotions that stir you up the most are oftentimes your area of growth and development, like the emotions that you need to grow most with. They like their behavior, it's just like a flashlight on yourself, and it comes back and points at you, and you're like, oh, okay. And but I mean, the beautiful thing is that's human development, is that we're offered this unique opportunity to grow and stretch. But I love what you're saying is, you know, to go kind and gentle on herself and to have mercy and forgiveness. And I don't know how, as a parent, like, I don't think you're ever left with a sense that you've done everything, you did everything well. Like, that's just part of the instincts and emotions that push us to become a caretaker. You're constantly paying attention to it. You're, you feel guilty when you don't do what you intend to do, because it impacts a child now. So you're never really free of that. And so the only way to get through it is to feel the feelings around it, to feel our sadness around it, and to realize that human relationships don't actually work without grace and forgiveness and mercy for them and for us. And so I've gotten to know those emotions a lot more as a parent in my own journey with myself, and certainly with my kids. It is an imperfect game. And this is the big thing, though, that, and I hope people understand this from my work, is that nature has a role in playing our kids up, in growing our kids up. We have a role to play, but nature primed them with dynamics to grow. If we can provide the necessities for healthy growth and development in the conditions, there is a whole blueprint inside of them. Just like their bodies grow, so do they psychologically and emotionally. We have a role to play, but it's not all on us. And I think that's what also paralyzes us as parents, is we think every little thing we do makes the difference. Well, sometimes we think a little too much of ourselves.
You know, before being a parent, I would have that thought so clearly, to be like, listen, you are obviously a big part of your children, but they're their own individual person. You could raise two kids the exact same way that turn out totally differently. So I'm like, parents, ease up. Easy for me to say when I wasn't a parent. And now when I'm a parent, I'm like, and I need to remind myself of that. It's like, obviously we can do everything that we can do to set up the environment in the best way that we can. And let me add, what are some of the, you mentioned that, what are some of the things that we can actually do to try to set up that really positive, good environment for our children to set them up in the best way?
Well, what nature needs most of all from us to play midwife to their development, so we're midwives, is there's four irreducible needs that we have to meet. And if we don't get there, then development is hampered or to varying different degrees will unfold. And a child might not get to their potential or have to deal with that later on in terms of their development. And the first one is attachment. Of course, it's about human relationship, feeling deeply attached. And, you know, there's a whole science and theory around attachment. That's a base primary need. The second thing that they need is they need to feel. They need to feel their vulnerable feelings. Now, we all know that, but what's the most interesting part of that is why don't we always feel our vulnerable feelings? That's the more interesting story anyway to me. And so how do we help promote our children's emotional maturity so they can grow to understand that emotional world that exists inside of them and have words for it? How do we play midwife to that? The third thing that they need is play. They need play to develop. Play, true play, where they express themselves on the world around them. Who they are and their emotional development actually really happens in play. And so not counterfeit play that we see today, but the kind of play where a child is at the steering wheel in their own life. And the final thing is just rest. They need emotional, psychological rest. And that means not having to work at the conditions to help grow themselves up, whether that's food, whether that's sleep, whether that's pursuing attachment, contact, and closeness. Their job is not to work. And unfortunately, we make our kids work far too much now to grow themselves up. It's like, I don't know what's happened in North America. We've lost such a developmental plot here, but we sure put our kids in charge of way too much when it comes to their own growth and development. They need to rest in our care, and we need to make sure we don't overturn that sacred bond that is our role to play.
What are some examples of parents doing that? You know, not raising them, allowing them to kind of just...
Well, I think in North America in particular is our love of asking questions. You know, are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you sick? What are you feeling? What do you need? Do you need a jacket? You won't take it. Well, then this is your fault. Questions, questions, questions. We turn them into consultants in terms of their own care. They're not meant to be telling us how to take care of them. In fact, what it can oftentimes convey, especially if you have a very bright, perceptive child, is that we really don't know how to take care of them. You wouldn't go into a job and ask your boss. You know, like if your boss started asking you, you know, or you asking your boss, you just like, well, didn't I hire you to do this job? Don't you know how to do it? So you kind of talk yourself out of a job. So we're in love with questions. We're in love with this whole idea of more independence early is better. You know, the faster that you read, you know, the more that you can, do it for yourself. This whole idea that we promote growth and maturity by letting kids figure it out on their own. Oh, let's let the preschoolers, you know, fight and figure out conflict resolution skills. Have you met a preschooler? They're not civil. They're not social. By three, they're incredibly territorial, but we'll just let them figure out social skills. No, they are nowhere near that. But we have this whole idea that if we promote more independence, that they're going to grow somehow. No, they actually get quite wounded by each other. We retire ourselves way too early. And so these would be some, and we act like we don't know what we're doing. Now, let's face it. We oftentimes don't know how to deal with some stuff, especially if it's the first time around. But I think past generations of parents, their faults and all, one of the things that there was, I think that we've lost, is there was a sense of confidence or a sense of that they were in the lead and that they would, you know, provide, that they knew they were the one to take care of the situation. And I think that confidence really matters a lot. So these are some of the ways that we're overturning this whole attachment system where they're supposed to rest in our care.
This is amazing. So that's something that me and my wife have we fell into a little bit where mm-hmm. we would ask her questions because this is awesome. We wanted to give her, so my thought on this is that before coming into this physical body, we are infinite beings, fully abundant. There's nothing keeping us down or lack. And when we come into these physical bodies, that obviously changes a lot. So my perception through that lens was, hey, I want to be able to give her freedom. I want her to still feel infinite. I don't want her to feel pushed down or shoved down by me saying like no in certain situations to her. And then so we would balance, but we would ask her questions. And we started to realize together, me and my wife, it's like, this doesn't feel right. This is like not the path because she is too young to make all those decisions. Yes. How stressed out do some adults get when you have to make too many decisions? Oh. Now imagine putting that on an infant, on a child.
Exactly.
And that's what I started to think. I'm like, I feel like we're stressing her out. Like I'm getting stressed out in moments when we ask her a question and then I have to decide, or like I'm thinking from her perspective, how is she going to choose right now? So this is great because, and it comes from like a place of love. It comes from a place of like abundance. We want you to like flourish and like explore and be you, but yes. No, they need our guidance. They need our discipline. And I'm really learning that in the moment. It's like, she needs us to make these decisions for her, not to leave it open-ended all the time, to help kind of carve those paths in her brain, yeah. Right, as opposed to just leaving it wide open and allowing it to go any which way at any moment.
Yeah.
And well, even, thank you. And we even started to, even in the questions now that we do ask, no can't be an, like if we, I don't know, if she's going to like eat or something, we're going to sit her down to eat food. Trying to think of a good example, but it's like, we're not asking her questions. We're like, she has to eat. We're not giving her the option to say yes or no, we're eating. We're like, hey, would you like this or that maybe sometimes, but it's gotta be yes. Like we're not giving her when we ask her questions now, we're not asking them in the sense where she can say no to them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, honey, do you want to come do this with us right now? Like taking a bath. Like, hey, honey, do you want to come take a bath right now? She can say no to that. Like, no. We are taking a bath, so we can't leave that open to her to say no, because this is actually the thing that we do have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Bath time.
Yeah. And
what I love about what you're saying is I think you've got this real sense of not wanting to squash your child's spirit and to let her unfold in her own unique way. And the best place that kids do this is in play. And so because nothing is for real in play, there's no consequences here. You're not going to get hurt. You're experimenting. You're discovering yourself. And so what's our job is to provide the emotional tethering so that they are free, they're at rest, so they can go into play. So you can't be an explorer if you don't have a home. You're homeless then. And so your constant pursuit is one of attachment. But if you are tethered, if you do feel a strong connection, then what happens is that you just push into play. I'll never forget my daughter. I picked her up one day in kindergarten at lunchtime, and I here in Canada, you can put them in all day or part day kindergarten. And she was very young, so I kept her in part day kindergarten. So I picked her up. The place was empty. She comes running out. I look at her. I'm like, oh, there you are. I've missed you all day, or half, you know, the morning. She comes running out. She comes running to me. Usually she'd come in and jump into my hands, you know, and you have a nice, beautiful hug and, you know, those ideal parenting moments. She gets about 6 feet away from me. She throws her backpack at me and she says, hi, mom. And then she runs to the park. And I'm standing there waiting for my big hug going, I wanted a hug. But the thing is what was happening for her is that her sense of separation, her need for connection was being filled up. All the time she could look at me, see my invitation, she was filling, filling, filling. And then at some point, 6 feet away from me, her brain said, yeah, I'm done. I'm full. Thank you for your service. And her brain said, time to play. And off she went. Now, I've done my job. I've done my job. She's free to play. Her brains and her body and her spirit is like, ooh, expressing itself everywhere. She's figuring out who she is. If we did an MRI of the brain, we would see it's on fire. It's lighting up. The network possibilities and neural connections are just going wild. And in play, that's the freedom. That's the point in which we don't want to press down upon. But they can't get there if they don't have that safe attachment to fall back on.
You know, as you're saying, it feels so right. It all makes like so much sense, because as a parent, you have so much going on. I mean, all of us do, even when you're not a parent. It's so easy just to literally say like, hey, honey, you want to go take a bath without thinking? You know what I mean? In most situations, you say, hey, dude, you want to go do this? Hey, buddy, you want to go do this? Hey, babe, yeah. To my wife, you want to go? You know what I mean? It's so easy just in those moments to say, oh, hey, do you want to do this? And really realizing that that's not setting her up really for success. And I feel like it's setting her up more for her brain to be more chaotic than it can be. Like I want to help her in moments just like settle. You know what I mean?
So here would be the thing, right? You want to get them into the bath, and preschoolers have one track mind. So soon, and they often, especially by the age of three, it's the age of autonomy. So you say yes, they say no. You want chocolate ice cream? No, I don't. And then they change their mind, and you see them everywhere. And so they have this incredible instinct, we all do, called counterwill, to resist and oppose when we feel someone else's agenda is on us. And at three, it really comes to life if a child's doing really well. They want to be their own person. They'll say, no, me do. I do it myself. No, you call me this. They want their toast cut a certain way, or like, where did you come from? It's like, well, I'm a product of good attachment. So one of the best ways, this, like, it's like magic, it is to collect the child and engage their attachment instincts. So you get in their face in a friendly way, you pay attention to what they might be paying attention to, what they're playing with. Hey, what is, you know, what are the trains doing? What are the dolls doing? Oh my goodness. Oh, you make your funny noises, your whatever. You collect and engage. So what you're saying to their attachment brain is, I'm here, you will follow. It's kind of like the Jedi move. You will follow. But collecting, collecting, collecting. You would go up to someone and say, hey, I need $5. You'd say, or I need a drive. You say, hey, how's it going? How's the weather? What are you doing? You know, would you? And once you feel they're yours, then you say, hey, by the way, could you help me out? Do the same with preschoolers. They're one track mind. So you go and collect. You say, guess what time it is? You put a little bit of play into it. I'll race you. I'm going to be a, you know, elephant. You'll be a mouse. Let's see who can get there first. You put a little bit of play in it, and preschoolers don't feel coerced. They feel it's fun, and away we go. You need to get them to the bath. You need to get them to the dinner table. You need to get them out the door. The more you're commanding, demanding, bossy, the more oftentimes the resistance goes, nope, and they dig in, and they'll do the opposite. So just put some play in, collect them. It's like parenting magic.
I feel like it's so natural. All of us, when you feel pressure and forced to do something, you instantly don't want to do it.
Exactly.
Like adults, same thing.
An instinct.
Luckily, our daughter is great with the bath. She's great with sitting at the table. So all those things, like, luckily for us, are easy. But we will just in moments be like, hey, honey, you want to go take a bath? And it's like, mm-mm. Honey, we're going to take a bath.
She's not three yet. You still got to win. It's coming, Justin. I'm just telling you. That's coming.
That's what I was just thinking. She's good now, but I need to remember this information really for when the time comes where she is more rebellious and doing things like that.
It's a sign of wonderful development when a child can say, I do it myself, me do, look at here I am, I've arrived. We should have a psychological birthday by the time they're three and they start to say, I'm finally here.
I'm like, when she has little moments of independence, I love that. I'm like, yeah. Yes. Like, she's like, no. Like, she'll like push, like wave us away because she wants to do something on her own. It's awesome. It's not like, oh, you don't need my help anymore. I'm like, do you? Yes. Be independent. Figure things out for yourself. Like, we're not going to be here forever. And it's like, she's so young. I don't want to like push those on her yet. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Right. That's the thing too about being a parent is figuring out when to allow certain things for the betterment of your child. You don't want to push things on them too young, but they're really key things that children need to learn. Me and my wife will have that conversation. We're like, okay, I don't think yet with this thing. Let's give it another maybe like 6 months before we actually bring this in.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, if there was a golden rule, I would say try anything that's close to attachment or separation, anything that represents relationship or caretaking that we're meant to be responsible for, you know, around rest or play or attachment or feelings, then we must take a strong lead on that until they're really ready and mature to take the wheel. So, you know, what they eat, I mean, I still do that for my kids, any opportunity, and they're in university, you know, because it's an act of caretaking. It's, you know, sleeping, you know, when they start to move into teenagers, you still have to kind of support them. Get off the devices. Let's go. You don't need to be in a police officer, but they still need support. So try not to act, you know, retire ourselves too soon on the things that are key. But where do they take responsibility? Homework, choosing their friends, what, you know, activities they're interested in, how much food they want to eat, what they like as far as their tastes. But there's room where they are meant to take the lead and have some autonomy, increasingly so. And there's things that come that deal with caretaking that we really want to cement our position. And yes, they might have a little bit more latitude, but we're still not making ourselves, we never want to be irreplaceable or redundant. There's always a sense of, I'll take care of you. My kids still need a place to come home to from university. They still need a mom to call to when they're having a hard day. I mean, as adults, we all still long for that. So try not to retire yourselves in the areas most important for caretaking.
Like, that is an interesting balance of allowing them to be independent, but also still caretaking and being their parent and just kind of figuring that out. It's so funny. Before, you know, I feel like a common thing that parents say is like, hey, there was no playbook on you. You know, I just have to figure it out. And I never really got what that meant. I was like, of course there's no playbook. Of course, every kid's like their own. Like, of course, like, what are you talking about? Because it's every single moment is like, how do I handle this in the best way? Every single moment, how do I take a step forward in this situation to do the best for my children, right? And raise them in the best way, to set them up in the best way for them to be successful, for them to be loving, for them to be kind. Like, and that's what it is. It's every single moment I feel like, okay, what, which do I step right or left in order to, again, provide the sort of environment and help guide them in the way that we're trying to guide our children to be, you know, self-sufficient in moments, to be independent, to be loving, to be kind, to contribute positively towards the world, but also not get stepped on or walked over. It's like this very fickle balance that we're just kind of always in. And like, there is literally no playbook for each individual situation. And it's just kind of in that moment doing our best.
Well, and keeping attachment in mind and keeping their emotions in mind. I think if we keep those two things in mind, most of all, our relationship with them, their relationship to themselves, and helping them on the path to emotional growth and maturity, those two things are important. I will tell you something, though, is that I think in the moment, we hope that we can show up and do the right thing, but actually we blow it a lot. And the best times of growth, I think, are in reflection. So I used to do, you know, when my kids especially were young, I would do kind of a post-mortem on the day and think, well, what didn't sit well with me at the end of the day about how I showed up? Because I'm responsible, right? My preschooler's not responsible for how I show up, and I need to change if I need to change. So I would sit in reflection and I would just pay attention to those emotions that were there: regret, guilt, confusion, doubt, conflict, joy, excitement, pride, delight. And I would say, what did I learn today about, well, that didn't work well. Oh no, I'm learning about my child. I'm learning about myself, or things that did work well. But the things that would haunt me the most were the things that didn't work well. And here's the great thing is if they had a temper tantrum that you blew today, trust me, they're going to have one tomorrow, maybe two or three, and you're going to get lots of opportunity to show up differently. And so that's development, right? Development is that we just try to do a little bit different or better the next day or the next time it comes around. We're not going to stick a perfect landing. I would feel paralyzed because you just can't. You're experiencing things for the first time through. That's why firstborns are so neurotic, right? I'm a firstborn, I can say that. Because our parents are just like figuring this out as they go. My youngest one, it's like, oh yeah, I've been there. You hate me? Yeah, okay, we'll get through that. But like the first time your child says it to you, like, whoa, that didn't feel great. You know, the second born, like, yeah, you know, we'll get through this too. And grandparents, oh, they got the easiest time because they've seen it all. They know you turn out and they're just like, yeah, this will pass.
That's the thing I think about too. I'm like, does this slight little moment really have an impact enough on her life that I need to be like this stressed or this worried about it? And I feel like a lot of times, no. But then I also think, if you take those little times and you put those over the course of her life and you add those up, well, then yes, then they do.
Exactly. But you're not going to keep doing the same thing because you're tormented by that one moment. And you care enough, right? You care. That's the whole thing. And what I love actually about this whole conversation is that, you know, oftentimes mothers are seen as the one as, you know, having these questions and doing this work. But, you know, you're a dad. You're built with the same emotions and desires to be a parent. Like, we're not... To take care of a child, it's not a gender thing. It's not an age thing. It's instincts. It's emotions. It's deep caring and feeling of responsibility. So if you feel deeply and you care deeply, you're going to get there because your emotions do torment you. They say, hey, knock, knock, that's not good. And you're just like, I know. And you know, so it doesn't happen for 20 years because you're tormented by your emotions and, or not tormented, but your emotions keep you awake and they make you try to pay attention until you figure it out. And then they go, they rest. And then the next thing comes up.
Exactly. And then the next thing comes up. It's so true. But that's something I'm experiencing right now. Since we've had our son, it has in moments taken me to some very dark places that I haven't been to in a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And it's like very terrifying, honestly. It's really scary. I'll just like catch myself crying in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And it's just been hard. But there's beauty and so much gratitude in those situations as well, too, because I can literally see myself and I feel it in my heart and my soul because I'm having these emotions that I don't want to have that are tormenting me in a sense and I'm reflecting on. It is forcing me to go deeper inside and to relook at these things that I thought I had healed or I thought that I'd look through and really figured out and change my perspective on them. They're coming back up to the surface again. And it's forcing me to go down deep, which is beautiful. So that's like a huge part of it. So I'm so grateful for that in itself. And I know, again, I'm becoming a better version of myself because these are coming up and because I'm reflecting and assessing myself and going deeper. And it's an interesting place to be. It's like, I literally have moments I'm just like down and just like so dark. And then in this same instance with it, I'm like, wow, but there's such gratitude here. And it's funny to be in both places at the same time.
How beautiful you can be and how healthy to be able to feel your mixed feelings, because that's what prevents you from going in one direction or the other, right? And so we do have to look at ourselves, and yet it does have to mix. So yes, there is sadness and there's frustration, but there's also deep caring and there's hope. There's also joy. And so it's the mixing of all these emotions that pushes our development along and eventually also pushes our kids' development along. But, you know, when I was doing my counseling training as a graduate student, I remember commenting to my professors, it's just like, it's like a spiral, you know, you're here and then you spiral around, you seem to come back to that place again, but it's a deeper level. So it's not like these, you know, our understanding of ourselves just deepens. We grow a deeper relationship with frustration or resistance or sadness or whatever it is that we carry in our lives, or shame. We just carry and develop a deeper relationship with it. And that's what maturity and wisdom looks like. And so you need some sort of outside force to help you get there. Children are the best forces around to make you have to grow, because you have to assume responsibility for their immaturity, which presses all your buttons. But it allows you to grow into a deeper understanding of it. If you embrace the vulnerability, if there's enough caring, if there is enough, if you're not too defended or stuck against those feelings, you can do the growth. Where we struggle most as parents is where we're most stuck or defended against those feelings. And then that's where our own growth is really can come to a bit of a stuck place, which we can get through, but we have to feel those feelings to get through.
I'm really feeling, and like at least learning in myself, that I feel like my children are going to be my greatest teachers for sure.
Yeah.
Because I really did. I it makes me laugh at myself, because I really was like, whoa, I got this shit figured out. I got life like pretty figured out right now. It's like,
oh, I remember that feeling. Oh. Disabused. It's such a humbling experience, you know. I remember that just like, whoa, I don't think I understood what this was all about.
And like that growth, like, so say I'd never had kids, I still would have grown, but I would have stayed in that place of like, yeah, I'm cool. I got the stuff figured out. I need these challenges. I need these difficult moments. I need my children in moments to be my teacher so that I can bust through and grow more and elevate more, because if they never brought these things out of me, I wouldn't go as deep as I'm going to go, and I wouldn't grow as high as I'm going to grow with them forcing me and making me look inward and having these sorts of very, very difficult experiences that are really beneficial. They're very difficult, but they're very beneficial for our overall growth and our overall well-being. And I wouldn't have that without them, without these really challenging times.
And here's the challenge, is that we largely have to try to hide that experience from our children, in the sense that we don't need them to know how we feel about being their parent. That might alarm them. Actually, we don't need them to know our conflict and our own challenges that we have from, you know, back at our own ranch that we grew up with. That process happens it can happen invisibly. It can happen with our adult counterparts whom we share with. But from our children's perspective, what they care about most of all is, can you and will you take care of me? And so it's this interesting process that's happening inside of us that we, I oftentimes think about those cartoons where there's the parent who has their outside voice and then the inside bubble in their head, like, I'm sorry you're having a hard time. Yes, I know you didn't get another cookie. This is very challenging. I know, very frustrating. And in your head, you're just like, oh my God, it's just a cookie. Are you for real? Grow up. but your outside voices, and that's why you being tempered and full of conflict and being able to, filter what comes out is one of the greatest gifts you could give your kids. It's not that you don't have your emotions and your feelings about it. It's just that they're not meant to carry it. And so what I think the biggest challenge is that in past generations, children really carried a lot of the emotions that their parents were meant to carry. And that burdens us and doesn't allow us to be free to become our own, individual selves this way without carrying those unfinished emotions. So that's really the key, is have all our emotions, but don't let them just come out unfiltered onto our kids.
I like that a lot, because I think that really creates more mindfulness.
Yeah.
Right? Because if we're not mindful in those moments, that internal thought of, oh my God, it's just a cookie, shut up about it. You know what? That will come out. It's us being mindful in these moments, hearing that thought, saying, hey, that's not how I want to raise my child. That's not the thought I want to come out right now. And then actively thinking and choosing a new thought, so then that thought can come forth. And that's the energy and the thought your child sees, maybe not that frustrated, really aggravated thought, because they shouldn't have to take on that burden. Like that's not fair to them. That just feels, as I even think about them taking on that burden, that like breaks my heart.
Yeah. Well, because they're seeing it through the lens of relationship. They feel ashamed. I'm not good enough. What's wrong with the relationship? Am I safe? Can I trust this person? Like, the child isn't viewing it through a larger context about cookies or mealtime, or that, sometimes you're like this, or maybe you're tired, or maybe you're stressed. Like, a child's just living in the moment. So they're confused by it. They're seeing it through relationship. But we don't see the world that way, but they look at us this way. And so it's just understanding that it's different for us both.
Yes. And one of the things I love that you talk about is nourishment with food. But because when we think about nourishment, we think food. That's my first thought when I think about, let me nourish myself. It's like, okay, let me eat really good leafy green, organic, just healthy, non-processed. That's what I think instantly. And I love how you pull the aspect of food into the relationship with the child and that connection. And I feel like, and that development between you and your child, it's more than just providing them a meal. Yes.
One of the most consistent places we have to show up and provide caretaking. I'll take care of you. I provide generously. I provide often. You can count on it. Because, our most important need is attachment, but our second most important need is food. And so they're meant to go together. And you're meant to be fed in the context of attachment. But particularly in North America, food is fuel. Food is just for the body, as if the body is separated from the mind, heart, spirit. It's not. They're all meant to go together. Nature wired it up. You're meant to know the sounds, the smells, the tastes of your people, and follow that so that you can stay anchored, that you have a place of rest, so that your body can come to rest when you eat. So, your emotional well-being, your relational well-being isn't separate from food. It's not like you have it over here and it's like, oh, we'll take care of this over here. They're meant to be all intertwined, but we have come apart. It's like food, fuel, nourishment. Nutritionism has taken off. Eating challenges are taking off. Why? Because we're trying to take matters of food into our own hands. We're alarmed about it, but we were all meant to just rest in the care of somebody when it comes to this and not focus on food so much. When did cake get to be so horrible? Like, it's like death, it's just like, we are afraid of something that actually was meant to take care of us in the hands of our caretaker. And what parents are most concerned about today is, how do I make my child receptive to what I have to offer? What do I do to the food? What do I have to, tricks and treats and bribes and threats or consequences? Clean your plate, it's never been about the food. It's been, we all have a natural bias to eat. It's been about who feeds you. So what the research shows is that about 87% of parents feel pretty confident in what they're supposed to feed their kids. Think about that. Like over 85% of parents say, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know what is the best to feed my kids. But over 70% of parents say they don't know how to get their child to eat more healthy, eat the food that they provide, how they eat. Parents are like, we don't have a clue on that part. That's where parents are stuck. That's all about relationship.
So can I, so again, we're very lucky in this situation. She just eats, we feed her really well, yes. And she climbs on her chair on her own and does her thing. For the parents, for the parents who have a child who's a tricky eater, or for my future self who may run into this, it's like, oh, we got this figured out. We don't, you know what I mean? So in my
mind, haven't hit three yet.
Exactly.
It's that of autonomy. Well, picky eating is really typical up to about the age of 2.5 to 3, because there is this developmental burst in a child where they don't simply just want to be fed. They're an eater now. And so they show more preferences. If there's any kind of coercion, they back up. They can be quite shy around foods that you've previously fed, because again, they're trying to figure out if I like this, not just if I'm just simply given this. You know, it's so interesting. The more you focus on food, oftentimes the more messed up it gets. Eating family style, eating together, if we are truly together, if a place of eating is a place of connection, then typically children want to follow, be like, be introduced to, take their time, come to experiment. You know, like think about play. They play with things. They come to squish things and throw things and taste it, and they decide if they like it or not. But there has to be some room for autonomy and play. And when a child hits that age of autonomy around 2.5 to 3, a new relationship with food is meant to unfold, and we need to be patient. It's like kids in Mexico don't start eating hot chili peppers out of the womb. They don't like it actually at 2, but by 5 or 6, they love it and they eat like the rest of their family. Why? Because they've been in a place of connection where it's not coerced. They want to eat like, be like the people that they're attached to. But we need to provide some space and autonomy. So we're very much focused on outcomes. Is it good? How much should you eat? Eat some more. This isn't good. And we are so behaviorally focused, we've lost sight that this is all meant to be developmentally and relationally driven. We've completely eclipsed those things. And we wonder why we're in trouble.
I'm going to ask, how can we create that for my future self or those parents out there right now that, you know, maybe it is in their mind, just this is food, this is just nutrition, it's just fuel, or their child is tough, right? They're not wanting to sit down. They're not wanting to eat. How can we create that sort of environment and that sort of connection with our children to help stimulate this sort of environment that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, this is a great question. And there's many things that we can do. But number one is to realize that we've inherited a whole system and a belief structure around food that isn't this way. So we're in trouble. So first of all, it means a rethinking and a reexamination of our comfort around food, how we set the context for food. You know, when I was doing research for Nourished, the number of people said, you know, I just didn't really eat and I just snacked. And then I had kids. I'm like, oh my God, I got to feed them. And it's just like, I got to learn how to cook. I got to whatever. Not everybody's going to cook everything for their kids. That's fine. But I think what it is, it's a real focus, A, to examine yourself and what you bring to it. B, how you consistently show up to take the lead around food, and how you set the stage for it. And that could be simply like a single mom having a coffee with her kid who's eating cereal in the morning, and you're eating together and you're connecting about the day. It doesn't have to look like Leave It to Beaver in this perfect scenario. That's just a performance. That doesn't mean you're connected. So how do you put the two together? How do you make a shift towards making sure that this is a place of rest? How do you set the stage? How do you set the context? Is it family style? Is there a way of coming? Like how I look at it is it should be a place of rest where we come together, things are parked, and we just are together for the purpose of connection. Food's part of that. It's a celebration of it. So how do you do that? You could do that on a picnic blanket. You could do that for breakfast. You could do that a snack in a car when I connect my kids after school and say, I brought you a snack. Let's just pull over. We're going to have a bit of a snack before you go play your soccer. And we connect, we talk about our day, but not here's your food, here's your fuel, go get out there. It's good for you. Don't you know there's antioxidants in it? It's going to make your body strong. You don't want to lose your eyes, eat your carrots. Like, I mean, that's all work, and food's, you know, then becomes work. Oh God, I got to eat this to keep my eyeballs. It's just like nobody enjoys food that way. It should be pleasurable. It should be a place of rest. So create the context, focus on relationship, make sure you're examining your own relationship to food. Use, you know, collect your kids. There's all sorts of things that we can do, but it's part of it is actually shifting. Actually, part of it's realizing something's broken and then actually saying, okay, wow, now how do I go in to repair this and put this back together in whatever context I'm in school, in home, in institutional setting, on an airplane, in outer space. You could, this is anywhere we eat. This should be our focus, but we don't have that in North America. It's gone.
I love that. That's like the first step, which is so true that you said, is first being aware that this is not how we typically think about things here. And we have to have that awareness first to be like, okay, because that's like really the starting off point. You're like, this is what it is. This is not how we do things. So what we're trying to accomplish right now, that's not the norm. So first understanding that, like, that other side exists, that is the societal norm of North America, and realize, okay, that's not what we're trying to do. And then you can start to move away in whatever direction that you want to go. Because I think it's so easy just to get caught up in it and just to sit them down, not think about it, shove food in their mouth so that they have energy and they can go. And not so often we forget really though that food years and years and years ago was this beautiful like sacrament, and you sat with each other and you talked about your day and you shared your stories, and it gave us a reason to sit near each other and to have this community and to have this connection. And just to, you know, that human connection is so important, and food was really one of the things that I think really helped that thrive for such a long time. And now we're in such the go, 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 hurry up, that food really, like you've been saying, is just there as fuel. Yeah. Like sometimes even for myself, I have too much going on. And I'm like, I'm just so hungry. I don't even think about it as food. I think about it as just energy giving to me as quickly as possible, just so I can refuel and then keep moving with the day.
Mm-hmm. And that might take care of your body, but it doesn't mean it takes care of everything else. There's the poet, Leon Abrick said, you know, the immortal gods show up at the table and twice a day. They're immortal gods. They don't have to eat, but why do they show up at the table twice a day? You know, when I was going through the research, I thought, you know, are there animal species that don't actually have to eat that often? And I found like a snake that eats and they don't eat for 2 years. I'm thinking, how would you have a relationship with a snake that didn't need to see you or need you for 2 years? They're reptiles. They can find their way. They've got instincts, whatever. They take care of everything. Like, how could you take care of a child if you only showed up every 2 years as their parent? Like, how fortuitous that nature gave us a stomach that empties so quickly. And you got to, because you got to collect. You got to get in their face. You got to represent yourself as the caretaker. I think nature was wise. She wasn't trying to torment us with these little small bellies that get empty. She was trying to make sure that you knew your people, you knew your home, you had a place of connection, because you could go anywhere. You could be attached to anybody, anything, any person's language, anybody's food. But how do you make sure you cement a home by showing up repeatedly to take care? I'm your answer. I've got food. Yes, I know. I know. I know. I've got it. Yes, your favorite cookies. I know. More cinnamon for you, less for you. You know, my brother, my nephew is here. He just left to go back home over the holidays. And so I made him a big breakfast because, you know, he wakes up at like 11 o'clock, right? So I make him his brunch. But I think I could just put it, he says, well, have you eaten? I'm thinking in my head, well, yeah, it's 11 o'clock. I'm on my second meal of the day, but I'm not there yet. And he's like, have you eaten? I'm like, yeah, it's okay. But I purposely made a cup of tea to sit down while he ate his breakfast. Why? Because that's connection. It's like, it's not just, you know, serve you up and you go, but you know what? It's a wonderful opportunity. I just made him a breakfast. I just sat down for 5 or 10 minutes because he eats fast, of course. And, just tried to gather him a little bit. It's a wonderful opportunity. They're receiving your food. They're more likely to receive you. You get your foot right in the door and say, I'm here.
Like, what a beautiful way, really, to set up that situation so that you can sit there and talk to him and have these moments. It's like, it gives us, I love that. It, like in that situation, especially, or in general, like gave you the opportunity to have time with him and to connect with him. And it gave you the opportunity to do something kind for somebody else too. You provided nourishment. You provided food. You provided this environment. Like that's the thing. It's not even just the nourishment. You provided this environment for him right now to probably feel safe, to feel good, to feel love.
And so many things divide us. You know, he's 18, so I don't listen to the same music. I don't move the same way. He's an incredible skier, flips and jumps. I couldn't keep up with this kid if I tried. He's, you know, at the beginning of his educational career, I'm at the end. Yes, we have some similarities and common things, but it's a place where I can be the answer when so much divides us. Screen time. We complain all the time about screen time, but we have this wonderful opportunity and, to exploit our kids' hunger, if you want to put it this way. Our teenagers are always hungry, to take opportunity here to put ourselves in their face away from a screen. So many things divide us, but we can come together and have this commonality and show up. So it's a way to hold on. It's a way to hold on. It's always been the way we've held on. That's why we pass recipes and seeds on, and we have our grandmother's favorite cookies and our cultural celebrations. It's always been a way to hold on, know our place, know our people, know our history, and feel connected to something that's much greater than just the people in front of us. It's nature, it's land, it's history. It's so rich. Why do we not do it? I'm just like, oh, or fools not to.
Do you think it's just the busyness and the craziness of life and the day? And in the explosion of the internet over the past 20 years, there's just so much in every single moment that's going on at any time. You know what I mean? And you can tap in there on anything. So
we've lost sight that human connection is what is necessary for survival. I mean, you know, and I talk about that with Maslow, you know, in what was it, 1943, he said food was more important. Maslow was actually a traumatized child who had no love actually in his home, didn't feel connected to his parents. His parents were quite cruel, according to the biographers. And so he created this whole archetype of needs based out of his own unmet needs. Food was the most important. Well, no, it's not actually. Love is. And in the context of love, you're meant to be served. But how many of us still hold on to this sacred hierarchy that guides our actions? Well, no, you got to give food. Well, no, food in the context of love. So we have a history that points us away from the fact that human connection is our most important need, and that our needs are served best in the context of those caring connections. We would have to restructure and rethink a lot of things that might not serve capitalism, materialism, globalization. If we did, all our sacred cows would have to be challenged. If we actually put what we need most of all for survival first, which a lot of our indigenous people have always known and have structured their societies around, which got run over and, you know, colonized. So yes, there are huge forces that push against it. But what can we do as parents? We do what we need to do in our home, in our relationships, with what we can do, and in our workplaces to the degree that we can. And it unfortunately falls now to parents to do this, right? Rather than expecting culture to take care of it for us, which is sad, but it's what's required.
As I think about that, that was like a nice thing I had growing up was my mom. We sat down and ate dinner always together. The TV was always turned off. Yeah. And I think it is just kind of creating that sort of environment in that moment. And as a kid, sometimes I'm like, can I just like watch TV? And I realize now as I'm getting older and having children, really how important, and even more and more in this conversation with you, how truly important it is to create that time so that we can be with each other. You're right, human connection is everything. That's why like depression, things happen. I mean, a multitude of reasons, but that could be one of them when we're disconnected from each other. Because I truly, in my heart and soul, know that we're one. And so when you try to disconnect from the wholeness, from the oneness, from the connection of the humans all around you, you're separating yourself from that oneness, and we cannot exist or thrive at all when we create that separation from ourselves between us and another. So if we can really think about it that way, we understand how truly, truly important it is to be with each other, to connect with each other, to love each other, to be kind to one another, to share these moments. It's like, that is what the moments of life are really made of. That's how I feel like we can feel really fulfilled. How we can live happier lives. It's when we have these moments with each other where we're being loving, where we're being empathetic, where we're being open, where we're being vulnerable. That to me is like the true spark and joy of life.
Yeah. And nature would agree with you. She said, that's how I wired you up. I wired you up to take care of each other, to be with each other. That's when we thrive. We have tons of research. We know this, is that togetherness and that sense of connection is what leads to longevity and well-being, emotional health and well-being. So the challenge is, well, how do we preserve that? How do we hold on to that? What does it look like for our child to feel connected to us? And what does it look like for us to stay connected to our child? Because attachment's a two-way street. So what are the challenges to connection? That's what I was going to say earlier with food or with play. The wonderful thing about feeding someone or playing with your child is it provides a medium through which you can be connected. Like, you know, with my nephew who's 18 years old, like a lot of things divide us, but food is a medium we can connect around. Or playing a game together is a medium through which we can come together. And so sometimes, you know, it's not like connection isn't just these set of skills that we have. I'd like to connect with you now. Let's make it vulnerable. I mean, it's awkward. It'd be weird. We just say, you know, you get into a relationship with someone, it's a sense of warmth. It's a sense of delight. It's a sense of enjoyment. These aren't things that we're meant to sit and think through, program, you know, formulaically. But if you come together around a meal, there's natural enjoyment. There's natural pleasure. If you come around and you're playing a game, there's a smile on your face. So people say, well, how do I get close to my kids? Well, find things that are pleasurable to do together, because that's when they see that you're happy to be with them. It's genuine. And that's when relationship takes form. The more coerced or contrived it is, then that's when everybody goes, no, thank you. It's too much. I don't go up to my teenager and say, oh, I need to give you a hug. I'm missing you. But I'll say, hey, do you want some food? Oh yeah. Like, they're far more receptive when there's a bit of a medium between you, right? It's less vulnerable, but it is vulnerable at the same time.
I love that. I love that medium for connection. That's so true. You can take people of opposite worlds and that's like a shift of dimension. It gives you that, it's like a portal for connection that didn't exist there before.
Exactly. Because it's too vulnerable otherwise. Sometimes you have to come around something that's invisible that represents connection. And then you're not working at it so hard and it feels like you slide into it. And so like a ritual or a whatever it might be, you know, it provides that sense of connection without it being too vulnerable. But because it's invisible, it works these beautiful magic on you to make you feel the warmth and the caring in other people.
It does. That's awesome. And I want to just be of service to everyone who's listening. So Deborah mentioned this quickly, but I definitely just want to, again, put this out there so that we can be of service. People can look into this. So the name of your new book, how long ago did the book come out?
September last year.
Amazing. It's called Nourished Connection, Food, and Caring for Our Kids and Everyone Else We Love. So just as you're picking up these things from Deborah, this knowledge and wisdom is awesome. And if you want to go deeper, I want to make sure this is out there. We'll put this in the show notes as well too. But I'm excited to take a look into this too. Is it available on Audible yet?
I just finished recording it. It's just being mixed, so it should be soon. Yeah.
Ah, amazing. Cool. All right. Fantastic. Everyone listening who wants just to dive deeper into this and more information, I say this about every guest, like reach out to Deborah, DM her on social media. We'll put the handles and everything down in the show notes as well too. But books are just like, when you have someone with your knowledge that puts out a book, to me, that's huge, because you could reach out to and you'd have to ask a million questions to get all the information that you put in a book. When instead of doing that, you can just go get the book and then just take it at your own speed, go through it on your own and be able to obtain and take in all of this great knowledge and information.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Yeah, the last half of the book is all kind of the how, like how we set the context, how we work at relationship, how we deal with emotional health and well-being, how we connect to nature, how we do this in a way that's in fitting with how we're meant to be, not what's contrived.
And then so Deborah, I'll ask you the question that I just ask every guest on the podcast as we just come towards the end. So my being now, Justin, in this version of my soul right now, I feel most aligned, most fulfilled when I am focused on and helping shift the collective consciousness of the planet through conversations like this, through other means of my life, through the social media page, through my everyday actions. But I'm just fixated on this idea because I know how
I know it's difficult, but I know how true it can be and how we can actually achieve this. So it's the idea of shifting the collective consciousness to one that's more peaceful, that's more kind, more loving, vulnerable, forgiving, accepting, a consciousness that's one. Mm-hmm. And I say that the consciousness we're in right now, that seems like light years away. But think about how different we are, our consciousness now, than it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 300 years ago. So it's just so possible, as long as we just know that it is. So for yourself, through your work, through your every single day, how do you feel like you are helping to contribute to this sort of a loving, positive shift of consciousness?
Thank you. What a beautiful question. And I certainly feel that resonates, what you said about yourself. It resonates with you. It's very genuine. You feel that about you. It's beautiful. I believe my greatest gift, any human's greatest gift, is similar to yours, is just your caring and your capacity to care for more than just yourself. And I believe, as most Indigenous belief systems did, is that our role was not to self-actualize, but to use our maturity and our actualization for the betterment of community. And I'm Celtic background, but I also come and have worked with our Indigenous people here in British Columbia, Canada. And that idea of seven generations ahead and what I leave and what I contribute to that, to my kids' generation and their communities. And so that deep caring, making the world a more caring place by caring and being in service to help support parents and questions and, you know, to make sure that our kids get the best of us. The greatest gift to a child is a parent who is there for them and cares for them. So that's my purpose. That's my being, is my, you know, till my days run out, is to contribute that to the world and hope it helps in whatever way it can help.
It's so beautiful. That's why, like, I love the work that you're doing, because you're helping guide the next generation, which is the future, which is everything. You're helping put them in the best place possible. You're helping teach their parents things that they can do so that we can raise a new generation of children that are going to be kinder and more loving and more empathetic to one another, that are going to see our unity first before they see our division. And so your work is just so imperative to help set up this next generation, because, right, the consciousness shift isn't in this moment. Where can we see it coming, at least in my mind, is in the future generations. And as we just continue to move forward, and we need to keep moving in this beautiful trajectory that I feel like we're going in right now. I know there's a lot of hate and terrible things out in the world, but there's more love, I think, than ever as well. And people are really opening their minds and their hearts to this idea of our oneness and understanding that we are truly one, that we're all connected. And how much more beautiful does it feel when we feel unity amongst each other and love than when we feel fear or separation or hate. And you're helping create that sort of a shift in who you are, but also in these millions of other people out there, right? You're like, that's the thing, you're planting the seeds in millions of people that will move forward and be that next generation. So just so much love and thanks. And I'm just so appreciative of the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you. And well, thank you for having me on to help, you know, continue that conversation. But yeah, we're deeply caring beings. It's a beautiful thing.
And then, so we touched on it for a second, but if you can just let people know where you're at on Instagram and your website, again, they'll go in the show notes, but if you can just put those here, and maybe just the best way that a parent or non-parent or whoever can reach out to you just to touch base, maybe get some advice or just seek your help in a really difficult time.
Sure, thank you. So my website's probably the best. It's deborahmcnamara.com or mcnamara.ca. Both of them work. Instagram, I think I'm Dr. Deborah McNamara. Isn't that terrible? It's not something or Facebook as well. My newsletters are actually where I put a lot of my emphasis and put my articles and stuff, because I figure rather than just blasting everybody, blast the people who have chosen to be blasted with information. So my newsletter sign up on my website is probably the best. But yeah, and Rest, Play, Grow for kids, for parents. Rest, Play, Grow is the first book I wrote in 2016, Making Sense of Preschoolers or Anyone Who Acts Like One. That's really helpful, I think, for parents under the age of six, but anyone who's immature, actually, it would help make sense of them. And Nourished as well. And of course, Neufeld Institute. I work with Dr. Gordon Neufeld, who wrote Hold On To Your Kids with Gaber Maté. And I would still say that's probably one of my most favorite parenting books out there is Hold On To Your Kids with Gordon Neufeld and Gaber Maté. And of course, Gaber Maté's work in all sorts of areas is also wonderful. But the Neufeld Institute is also another wonderful resource for parents.
It's great because I feel like people like you who are doctors, who are literally experts and who spend their life studying this and focusing on this, that's so needed too, because sometimes the common folk person like myself will just do in moments what we think is best. And that's not always the case. It may feel like it, but it may not be that way at all. For instance, and we touched on this a lot, but one of the things I had written down to talk to you about was the idea of attachment, because you talk about that a lot. I see in a lot of your posts. Yeah, a lot of posts about attachment. Children can't be too attached. And we went into that hard, which is awesome. But that's a big misunderstanding. I feel like a lot of times we have this idea of attachment, right? We don't want to be too attached to something because it leads us to be too vulnerable or not be able to be on our own if this attachment leaves or something like that. So to hear expert opinions based on actual studies, understanding that no, attachment is a very good thing. That's why it's so important too, right? To say, okay, we may think this thing, but this is the actual facts. This is what we've seen. This is what's been proven. And that's the direction that we should try to go in.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm glad it's helpful. But yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Attachment is everything.
Oh, I love that. Sweet. Deborah, thank you so much for being here and sharing all of your knowledge and the work that you've done over your career. I appreciate it so much. You've helped me a ton in this conversation. I'm sure a lot of parents out there who are listening too. If you are not a parent and you want to share this episode with someone who is, please do that. You don't know how difficult it can be and how literally any little bit of help can really go a very, very long way. If you are a parent and literally you have more questions about this, please reach out to Deborah. It's like, that's why I love having these guests on the podcast too, because it's like, use these people as a resource. Like, that's the whole purpose of this, is like sharing this knowledge here, but then also allowing that person to be a new resource for you moving forward. Because like, what's the point of knowing these things and not putting it into action, right? So let's do that as parents. And in those tough times or something here that was maybe a misunderstanding or something you want more clarity on, please reach out to Deborah so she can give you that clarity. You don't know how, you know, these little bits of perspective shifts can greatly alter who we are, how we show up, and our realities. So it is very important. And thank you so, so much for being here. I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Justin. I really enjoyed my time with you.
Yes, everybody, thank you for hanging out with us and being here with me and Deborah for a little while. We have so much love for you and cannot wait to see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please like, follow, share, subscribe, whatever you can do to help share this with the world. We put a lot of energy, effort, and time into creating this beautiful podcast with these incredible guests to help bring more awareness to the love that exists all around us. So if you can help spread some love, we'd really appreciate it. Love you.